company of soldiers. We can see who gets help first. The commandant thought about that for a while. Very well, he said eventually. Follow me. Two dirty children stared at West from the porch of one of the shacks as he stepped out of the commandant's building back into the incessant drizzle. You have children here? We have whole families, if they are judged a danger to the state. Lawson glanced sideways at him. A shame, but holding the Union together has always required harsh measures. I gather from your silence that you disapprove. West watched one of the shabby children limping through the muck, doomed perhaps to spend their whole life in this place. I think it's a crime. The commandant shrugged. Don't deceive yourself. Everyone is guilty of something, and even the innocent can be a threat. Perhaps it takes small crimes to prevent bigger ones, Colonel West, but it's up to bigger men than us to decide. I only make sure they work hard, don't prey upon each other, and don't escape. You only do your job, eh? A well-trodden way to avoid responsibility. Which of us is it who lives among them, out here in the middle of nowhere? Which of us is it who watches over them, dresses them, feeds them, cleans them, fights the endless, pointless war against their damn lice? Is it you who stops them beating and raping and killing each other? You're an officer in the King's Own, eh, Colonel? So you live in Adjua, in fine quarters in the Agrient, among the rich and well-groomed? West frowned, and Lawson chuckled at him. Which of us has truly avoided the responsibility, as you put it? My conscience has never been cleaner. Haters, if you like, we're used to it. No one likes to shake hands with the man who empties the latrine pits either, but pits have to be emptied all the same, otherwise the world fills up with shit. You can have your dozen Smiths, but don't try to take the high ground with me. There is no high ground here. West didn't like it, but he had to admit the man made a good case. So he set his jaw and struggled on in silence, head down. They squelched towards a long, windowless, stone-built shed, thick smoke roiling up into the misty air from tall chimneys at each corner. The practical slid back the bolt on the heavy door and heaved it open, and West followed him and Lawson into the darkness. The heat was like a slap in the face after the freezing air outside. Acrid smoke stung at West's eyes, nipped at his throat. The din in the narrow space was frightening. Bellows creaked and wheezed, hammers clanged on anvils, sending up showers of angry sparks. Red-hot metal hissed furiously in water barrels. There were men everywhere, packed in tight together, sweating and groaning and coughing, hollow faces half-lit by the orange glow from the forges. Devils in hell. "Stop your work!" roared Lawson. "Stop and form up!" The men slowly set down their tools, lurched and stumbled and rattled forward to form a line while four or five practicals looked on from the shadows. A shabby, broken, stooping, sorrowful line. A couple of the men had irons on their wrists as well as their ankles. They scarcely looked like the answer to all of West's problems, but he had no choice. This was all there was. "We have a visitor from outside. Say your piece, Colonel."
"My name is Colonel West," he croaked,
voice cracking on the stinging air.
"There are 10,000 soldiers camped a dozen miles down the road under Crown Prince Ladislaw. We have need of Smiths."
West cleared his throat, tried to speak louder without coughing his lungs out.
"Who among you can work metals?"
No one spoke. The men stared at their threadbare shoes or their bare feet with the odd sidelong glance at the glowering practicals.
"You need not be afraid. Who can work metals?"
"I can, sir."
A man stepped forward from the line, the irons on his ankles rattling. He was lean and sinewy, slightly stooped. As the lamplight fell across his head, West found himself wincing. He was disfigured by hideous burns. One side of his face was a mass of livid, slightly melted-looking scars. No eyebrow, scalp patchy with pink bald spots. The other side was little better. The man scarcely had a face at all.
I can work a forge, and I did some soldiering too in Gurkul.
Good, muttered West, doing his best to swallow his horror at the man's appearance.
Your name?
Pike.
Are any of these others good with metal, Pike?
The burned man shuffled and clanked his way down the line, pulling men forward by their shoulders, while the commandant looked on, his frown growing deeper with every passing moment. West licked his dry lips. Hard to believe that in so little time he could have gone from so horribly cold to so horribly hot, but here he was, more uncomfortable than ever.
I'll need keys to their irons, Inquisitor.
There are no keys. The irons are melted shut. They're not intended ever to be removed, and I would strongly advise you not to. Many of these prisoners are extremely dangerous, and you should bear in mind that you will be returning them to us as soon as you can make alternative arrangements. The Inquisition is not in the business of early releases.
He stalked off to speak to one of the practicals. Pike sidled up, pulling another convict by the elbow.
Pardon me, sir, he murmured, growling voice kept low, but could you find a place for my daughter?
West shrugged his shoulders, uncomfortable. He would have liked to take everyone and burn the damn place to the ground, but he was already pushing his luck.
It's not a good idea, a woman in amongst all those soldiers, not a good idea at all. A better idea than staying here, sir. I can't leave her on her own. She can help me at the forge. She can swing a hammer herself if it comes to that. She's strong.
She didn't look strong. She looked skinny and ragged, bony face smeared with soot and grease. West could have taken her for a boy.
I'm sorry, Pike, but it's no easy ride where we're going.
She grabbed hold of West's arm as he turned away.
It's no easy ride here.
Her voice was a surprise, soft, smooth, educated.
Cathil is my name. I can work.
West looked down at her, ready to shake his arm free, but her expression reminded him of something. Painless, fearless, empty eyes, flat like a corpse.
Ardy. Blood smeared across her cheek.
West grimaced. The memory was like a wound that wouldn't heal. The heat was unbearable. Every part of him was twitching with discomfort, his uniform like sandpaper against his clammy skin. He had to get out of this horrible place. He looked away, his eyes stinging.
There too,
he barked. Lawson snorted.
Are you joking, Colonel?
Believe me, I'm not in a joking mood.
Skilled men is one thing. I dare say you need them, but I cannot allow you to simply take whatever prisoners catch your eye.
West turned on him with a snarl, his patience worn right through.
Her too, I said.
If the commandant was impressed by West's fury, he didn't show it. They stood there for a long moment, staring at each other, while the sweat ran down West's face and the blood pounded loud in his temples. Then Lawson nodded slowly.
Her too. Very well, I cannot stop you.
He leaned in a little closer.
But the Archlector will hear about this. He is far away, and it might take time for him to hear, but hear he will.
Even closer yet, almost whispering in West's ear.
Perhaps one day you will find yourself visiting us again, but this time to stay. Perhaps, in the meantime, you should prepare your little lecture on the rights and wrongs of penal colonies. There'll be plenty of time for it.
Lawson turned away.
Now take my prisoners and go. I have a letter to write.
Chapter 10 Rain. Giselle had always found a good storm a thorough amusement. Raindrops lashing at the streets and walls and roofs of the Agriont, hissing from the gutters. Something to be smiled out at through the wet window while one sat warm and dry in one's quarters. Something that took the young ladies in the park by surprise and made them squeal, sticking their dresses excitingly to their clammy skin. something to be dashed through, laughing with one's friends as one made one's way from tavern to tavern, before drying out before a roaring fire with a mug of hot spiced wine. Giselle used to enjoy the rain almost as much as the sun. But that was before. Out here on the plains, storms were of a different stamp. This was no petulant child's tantrum, best ignored and soon ended. This was a cold and murderous, merciless and grudge-bearing, bitter and relentless fury of a storm. And somehow it made all the difference that the nearest roof, let alone the nearest tavern, was hundreds of miles behind them. The rain came down in sheets, dousing the endless plain and everything on it with icy water. The fat drops stung at Giselle's scalp like slingstones, nipped at his exposed hands, the tops of his ears, the back of his neck. Water trickled through his hair, through his eyebrows, down his face in rivulets and into his sodden collar. The rain was a grey curtain across the land, obliterating anything more than 100 strides ahead, although out here, of course, there was nothing ahead or anywhere else. Giselle shivered and clutched the collars of his coat together with one hand. A pointless gesture, he was already soaked to his skin. Damn shopkeeper back in Adua had assured him that this coat was entirely waterproof. It had certainly cost him enough, and he had looked very well in it in the shop, quite the rugged outdoorsman. But the seams had begun to leak almost as soon as the first drops fell. For some hours now he had been every bit as wet as if he had climbed into the bath with his clothes on, and a good deal colder. His boots were full of icy water, his thighs were chafed ragged against his wet trousers, the waterlogged saddle creaked and squelched with every movement of his unhappy horse. His nose was running, his nostrils and his lips were sore, the very reins were painful in his wet palms. His nipples, in particular, were two points of agony in a sea of discomfort. The whole business was utterly unbearable. "When will it end?" he muttered bitterly to himself, hunching his shoulders and looking up beseechingly at the gloomy heavens, the rain pattering on his face, in his mouth, in his eyes. Happiness seemed at that moment to consist of nothing more than a dry shirt. "Can't you do something?" he moaned at Baez. "Like what?" the Magus snapped back at him, water coursing down his face and dripping from his bedraggled beard. "You think I'm enjoying this? Out on the Great Plain in a bastard of a storm at my age? The skies make no special dispensation for magi, boy. They piss on everyone the same. I suggest you adjust to it and keep your whining to yourself. A great leader must share the hardships of his followers, of his soldiers, of his subjects. That is how he wins their respect. Great leaders do not complain, not ever." "Fuck them, then," muttered Giselle under his breath. "And this rain, too." "You call this rain?" Nine Fingers rode past him, a big smile spread across his ugly lump of a face. Not long after the drops began to come down hard, Giselle had been most surprised to see the Northman shrug off first his battered coat and then his shirt, roll them up in an oilskin, and ride on stripped to the waist, heedless of the water running down his great slab of scarred back, happy as a great hog wallowing in the mud. Such behaviour had at first struck Giselle as another unforgivable display of savagery, and he had only thanked his stars that the primitive had deigned to keep his trousers on. But as the cold rain began to seep through his coat, he had become less sure. It would have been impossible for him to be any colder or wetter without his clothes, but at least he would have been free of the endless, horrible chafing of wet cloth. Nine Fingers grinned over at him as though he could read his thoughts. "Nothing but a drizzle. The sun can't always shine. You have to be realistic." Giselle ground his teeth. If he was told to be realistic one more time, he would stab Nine Fingers with his short steel. Damn half-naked brute. It was bad enough that he had to ride and eat and sleep within 100 strides of a cave-dweller like that. But that he had to listen to his fool advice was an insult almost too deep to bear. "Damn useless primitive," he
he muttered to himself. If it comes to a fight, I reckon you'll be glad to have him along. Kwai was looking sideways at Giselle, swaying back and forth on the seat of his creaking cart, long hair plastered to his gaunt cheeks by the rain, looking more pale and sickly than ever, with a sheen of wet on his white skin. Who asked your opinion? A man who doesn't want opinions should keep his own mouth shut. The apprentice nodded his dripping head at Nine Fingers back. That there is the Bloody Nine, the most feared man in the North. He's killed more men than the plague. Giselle frowned over at the Northman, sitting sloppy in his saddle, thought about it for a moment, and sneered. Doesn't scare me any, he said, as loud as he could, without Nine Fingers actually hearing him. Kwai snorted. I'll bet you've never even drawn a blade in anger. I could start now, growled Giselle, giving his most threatening frown. Very fierce, chuckled the apprentice, disappointingly unimpressed. But if you're asking me who's the useless one here, well, I know who I'd rather have left behind. Why, you... Giselle jumped in his saddle as a bright flash lit the sky, and then another, frighteningly close. Fingers of light clawed at the bulging undersides of the clouds, snaked through the darkness overhead. Long thunder rolled out across the gloomy plain, popped and crackled under the wind. By the time it faded, the wet cart had already rolled away, robbing Giselle of his chance to retort. Damn idiot apprentice, he murmured, frowning at the back of his head. At first, when the flashes had come, Giselle had tried to keep his spirits up by imagining his companions struck down by lightning. It would have been oddly appropriate, for instance, had Baez been cooked to a cinder by a stroke from the heavens. Giselle soon despaired of any such deliverance, however, even as a fantasy. The lightning would never kill more than one of them in a day, and if one of them had to go, he had slowly begun to hope it might be him. A moment of brilliant illumination, then sweet oblivion, the kindest escape from this nightmare. A trickle of water ran down Giselle's back, tickling at his raw skin. He longed to scratch it, but he knew that if he did, he would only create 10 more itches, spread across his shoulder blades and his neck and all the places hardest to reach with a hooked finger. He closed his eyes, and his head slowly drooped under the weight of his desperation, until his wet chin hung against his wet chest. It had been raining the last time he saw her. He remembered it all with a painful clarity. The bruise on her face, the color of her eyes, the set of her mouth, one side twisted up. Just thinking of it made him have to swallow that familiar lump in his throat. The lump he swallowed 20 times a day. First thing in the morning when he woke, and last thing at night as he lay on the hard ground. To be back with Ardy now, safe and warm, seemed like the realization of all his dreams. He wondered how long she might wait as the weeks dragged on and she received no word. Might she even now be writing daily letters to Angland that he would never receive? Letters expressing her tender feelings, letters desperately seeking news, letters begging for replies. Now her worst expectations would all be confirmed. That he was a faithless ass and a liar, and had forgotten all about her when nothing could have been further from the truth. He ground his teeth in frustration and despair at the thought, but what could he do? Replies were hard to send from a blighted, blasted, ruined wasteland, even supposing he could have written one in this epic downpour. He inwardly cursed the names of Baez and Nine Fingers, of Longfoot and Kwai. He cursed the old empire, and he cursed the endless plain. He cursed the whole demented expedition. It was becoming an hourly ritual. Giselle began to perceive, dimly, that he had until now had rather an easy life. It seemed strange that he had moaned so long and hard about rising early to fence, or about lowering himself to play cards with Lieutenant Brint, or about how his sausages were always a touch overdone of a morning. He should have been laughing, bright-eyed, and with a spring in his step, simply to have been out of the rain. He coughed and sniffed and wiped at his sore nose with his sore hand. At least with so much water around, no one would notice him weeping. Only Pharaoh looked as if she was enjoying herself even less than him, occasionally glaring at the pissing clouds, her face wrinkled up with hatred and horror. Her spiky hair was plastered flat to her skull, her waterlogged clothes hung limp from her scrawny shoulders, water ran down her scarred face and dripped from the end of her sharp nose, the point of her sharp chin. She looked like a mean-tempered cat dunked unexpectedly in a pond, its body suddenly seeming a quarter of the size it had been, stripped of all its air of menace. Perhaps a woman's voice might be the thing to lift him from this state of mind, and Pharaoh was the nearest thing to a woman within 100 miles. He spurred his horse up alongside her, doing his best to smile, and she turned her scowl on him. Giselle found to his discomfort that at close quarters much of the menace returned. He had forgotten about those eyes. Yellow eyes, sharp as knives, pupils small as pinpricks, strange and disconcerting. He wished he had never approached her now, but he could hardly go without saying something.
"Bet it doesn't rain much where you come from, eh? Are you going to shut your fucking hole, or do I have to hurt you?"
Giselle cleared his throat and quietly allowed his mount to drop back away from her.
"Crazy bitch," he whispered under his breath.
Damn her, then. She could keep her misery. He wasn't about to start wallowing in self-pity. That wasn't his way at all. The rain had finally stopped when they came upon the place, but the air was still full of heavy damp. The sky above was still full of strange colours. The evening sun pierced the swirling clouds with pink and orange, casting an eerie glow over the grey plain. Two empty carts stood upright. Another was tipped up on its side, one wheel broken off, a dead horse still tethered to it, lying with its pink tongue lolling out of its mouth, a pair of broken arrows sticking from its bloody side. The corpses were scattered all around in the flattened grass, like dolls discarded by a bad-tempered child. Some had deep wounds, or limbs broken, or arrows poking from their bodies. One had an arm off at the shoulder, a short length of snapped bone sticking out as if from a butcher's joint. Rubbish was scattered all around them, broken weapons, splintered wood. A few trunks smashed open, rolls of cloth ripped out and slashed across the wet ground. Burst barrels, shattered boxes, rooted through and looted.
"Merchants," grunted Nine Fingers, looking down. "Like we're pretending to be. Life's cheap out here, all right."
Pharaoh curled her lip.
"Where isn't it?"
The wind whipped cold across the plain, cutting clean through Giselle's damp clothes. He had never seen a corpse before, and here were laid out, how many, at least a dozen. He started to feel slightly peculiar halfway through counting them. No one else seemed much moved, though familiarity with violence was hardly surprising among these characters. Pharaoh was crawling around the bodies, peering down and prodding them with as little emotion as an undertaker. Nine Fingers looked as though he had seen far worse, which Giselle did not doubt he had, and done far worse besides. Baez and Longfoot both looked mildly troubled, but not much more so than if they had come upon some unknown horse tracks. Quai scarcely even looked interested. Giselle could have done with a share of their indifference at that moment. He would not have admitted it, but he was feeling more than a little sick. That skin, slack and still and waxy pale, beaded with wet from the rain. That clothing, ripped and rifled through, missing boots or coats or shirts even. Those wounds, ragged red lines, blue and black bruises, rips and tears and gaping mouths in flesh. Giselle turned suddenly in his saddle, looking behind, to the left, to the right, but every view was the same. Nowhere to run to, if he had even known in what direction the nearest settlement lay. In a group of six, and yet he felt utterly alone. in a vast, open space, and yet he felt utterly trapped. One of the corpses seemed to be staring unnervingly straight at him. A young man, no more than Giselle's age, with sandy hair and protruding ears. He could have done with a shave, except, of course, that it hardly mattered now. There was a yawning red gash across his belly, his bloody hands lying on either side of it, as though trying to squeeze it shut. His guts glistened wetly inside, all purple-red. Giselle felt his gorge rising. He was already feeling faint from eating too little that morning. Damn sick of dry biscuit, and he could hardly force down the slops the others put together. He turned away from the sickening scene and stared down at the grass, pretending to be searching for important clues, while his stomach clenched and heaved. He gripped his reins as tightly as he could, forcing down the spit as it rushed into his mouth. He was a proud son of the Union, damn it! What was more, he was a nobleman of a distinguished family. What was still more, he was a bold officer of the King's Own, and a winner of the contest. To vomit at the sight of a little gore would be to disgrace himself before this mixture of fools and primitives, and that could under no circumstances be permitted. The honour of his nation was at stake. He glared fixedly at the wet ground, and he clamped his teeth shut, and he ordered his stomach to be still. Gradually, it began to work. He sucked in deep breaths through his nose. Cool, damp, calming air. He was in complete control. He looked back at the others. Pharaoh was squatting on the ground with her hand in one of the victim's gaping wounds, as far almost as her wrist. "Cold," she snapped at Nine Fingers. "Been dead since this morning, at least." She pulled her hand out, fingers slimy with gore. Giselle had belched half his meager breakfast down his coat before he had time even to slide out of his saddle. He staggered a couple of drunkard steps, took a gasping breath, and retched again. He bent over, hands on his knees, head spinning, spitting bile out onto the grass. "You all right?" Giselle glanced up, doing his best to look nonchalant, with a long string of bitter drool hanging from his face. "Something I ate," he muttered, wiping at his nose and mouth with his trembling hand. A pitiful ruse, he had to admit. Nine Fingers only nodded, though. "That meat this morning, most likely. I've been feeling sick myself." He gave one of his revolting smiles and offered Giselle a water skin. "Best keep drinking. Flush it away, huh?" Giselle sloshed a mouthful of water round his mouth and spat it out, watching Nine Fingers walk back to the bodies and frowning. That had been strange. Coming from another source, it might have seemed almost a generous gesture. He took another swig of water and began to feel better. He made, somewhat unsteadily, for his horse and clambered back into the saddle. "Whoever did it was well-armed and in numbers," Pharaoh was saying. "The grass is full of tracks." "We should be careful," said Giselle, hoping to impose himself on the conversation. Baez turned sharply to look at him. "We should always be careful. That goes without saying. How far are we from Darmium?" Longfoot squinted up at the sky, then out across the plain. He licked his finger and held it up to the wind. "Even for a man of my talents, it is hard to be accurate without the stars. 50 miles or thereabouts?" "We'll need to turn off the track soon." "We're not crossing the river at Darmium?" "The city is in chaos. Cabrion holds it and admits no one. We cannot take the risk." "Very well. Aostum it is. We will take a wide route round Darmium and off westward. A slightly longer path, but..." "No." "No?" "The bridge at Aostum lies in ruins." Longfoot frowned. "Gone, eh? Truly, God loves to test his faithful. We may have to ford the Aos, then." "No," said Baez. "The rains have been heavy, and the great river is deep. The fords are all closed to us." The navigator looked puzzled. "You, of course, are my employer. And as a proud member of the Order of Navigators, I will always do my utmost to obey, but I am afraid that I can see no other way.
If we cannot cross at Damium or at Aostum, and we cannot ford the river,
there is one other bridge.
There is?
Longfoot looked baffled for a moment, then his eyes suddenly widened.
You cannot mean...
The bridge at Alcus still stands?
Everyone glanced at each other for a moment, frowning. I thought you said the place was a ruin, said Nine Fingers.
A shattered graveyard, I heard, murmured Pharaoh.
I thought you said no one goes within miles of the place.
It would hardly have been my first choice, but there are no others. We will join the river and follow the northern bank to Alcus.
Nobody moved. Longfoot in particular had a look of stunned horror on his face.
Now, snapped Byers, it is plainly not safe to remain here.
And with that, he turned his horse away from the corpses. Quai shrugged and flicked his reins, and the cart grumbled off through the grass after the first of the magi. Longfoot and Nine Fingers followed behind, all frowns and foreboding. Giselle stared at the bodies, still lying where they had found them, their eyes staring accusingly up into the darkening sky.
"Shouldn't we bury them?"
"If you like," grunted Pharaoh, springing up into the saddle in one easy motion. "Maybe you could bury them in puke."
Chapter 11 Bloody Company. Riding. That was what they were doing. That was what they'd been doing for days. Riding, looking for Bethod, with winter coming on. Bog and forest, hill and valley. Rain and sleet, fog and snow. Looking for signs that he was coming their way, and knowing that there wouldn't be any. A lot of wasted time to the dogman's mind, but once you've been fool enough to ask for a task, you better do the one you're given.
"Stupid bloody job, this," snarled Dow, wincing and twitching and fussing with his reins. He'd never been too much of a one for horseback, liked to keep his feet on the ground and pointed at the enemy. "Waste of our fucking time. How do you put up with scouting, dogman? Stupid bloody job."
"Someone's got to get it done, don't they? At least I got a horse now."
"Well, I'm right delighted for you," he sneered. "You got a horse."
The dogman shrugged his shoulders.
"Better than walking." "Better than walking, eh?" scoffed Dow. "That just binds it all up. I got new breeches and all, not to mention good woolens. The wind don't blow half so cold round my fruits no more."
That got a chuckle from Tull, but it seemed Dow wasn't in a laughing mood.
"Wind round your fruits? By the fucking dead boy, is this what we come to? You forgotten who you are? You was Nine Fingers' closest. You came over the mountains with him in the first place. You're in all them songs along with him. You scouted at the head of armies. 1,000 men all following your say-so."
"That didn't turn out too happy for anyone concerned," muttered Dogman, but Dow was already laying into Tull.
"And how about you, big man? Tull Duru Thunderhead, strongest bastard in the north. Wrestled bears and won, I heard. Held the pass all alone while your clan got clean away. A giant, they say, 10 feet tall, born under a storm and with a belly full of thunder. What about it, giant? The only thunder I've heard you make lately is when you take a shit."
"What of it?" snarled Tull. "You any different? Men used to whisper your name, scared to speak it out loud. They'd grip their weapons tight and stick close by the fire if they thought you was within 10 leagues. Black Dow, they used to say, quiet and cunning and ruthless as a wolf. He's killed more men than Winter, and he's got less pity in him. Who cares a shit now, eh? Times have changed, and you rolled just as far downhill as the rest of us."
Dow only smiled.
"That's my point, big lad. That's just my point. We used to be something. Each one of us. Named men, known men, feared men. I remember my brother telling me that there ain't no better man than Harding Grimm with bone or blade. No better man in all the north. Steadiest damn hand in the whole circle of the world. How about that, eh, Grimm?"
"Aye," said Grimm.
Dow nodded his head.
"Exactly what I'm saying. Now look at us. We ain't so much rolled downhill as fell off a bloody cliff. Running errands for these southerners. These fucking women in men's trousers. These damn salad eaters with their big words and their thin little swords.
Dogman shifted in his saddle, uncomfortable.
That West knows what he's about. That West, sneered Dow. He knows his arse from his mouth, and in that he's a damn stretch better than the rest, but he's soft as pig fat, and you know it. Got no bones in him at all. None of them have. I'd be shocked to my roots if the better part of them have ever seen a skirmish. You reckon they'd stand a charge from Bethod's calls?
He snorted hard laughter to himself.
Now there's a joke. It can't be denied they're a piss-weak crowd,
muttered Tull, and the dog man couldn't very well disagree.
Half of them are too hungry to lift a weapon, let alone swing one with some fire, if they could even work out how. All the good ones went north to fight Bethod, leaving us here with the scrapings from the pot. Scrapings from a piss pot, I'm thinking. What about you, Free Trees? Called Dow. The Rock of Ufrith, eh? You were the spike up Bethod's arse for 6 months. A hero to every right-thinking man in the north. Rud Three Trees. There's a man carved out of stone. There's a man who never backs down. You want honour? You want dignity? You want to know what a man should be? Look no fucking further. What do you make of all this, eh? Running errands? Checking these bogs for Bethod where we all know he ain't? Work fit for boys, and we're lucky to get it, I suppose.
Three Trees pulled up his horse and turned it slowly round. He sat in his saddle, hunched up, tired-looking, and he stared at Dow for a minute.
"Open your ears and listen for once," he said, "'cause I don't want to be telling you this every mile we go. The world ain't how I'd like it in all kind of ways. Nine Fingers has gone back to the mud. Bethod's made himself king of the Northmen. The Shankar are fixing to come swarming over the mountains. I've walked too far and fought too long and heard enough shit from you to fill a lifetime, and all at an age when I should have me feet up with sons to take care of me. So you can see I got bigger problems than that life hasn't turned out the way you hoped. You can harp on the past all you please, Dow, like some old woman upset 'cause her tits used to stay up by themselves, or you can shut your fucking hole and help me get on with things."
He gave each one of them a look in the eye, and the dogman felt a touch shamed for doubting him.
"As for checking for Bethod where he ain't, well, Bethod's never been one to turn up where he's supposed to be. Scouting's the task we've been given, and scouting's the task I mean to get done."
He leaned forward in his saddle.
"So, how's this for a fucking formula? Mouth shut, eyes open."
And he turned and nudged his horse on through the trees. Dow took a deep breath.
"Fair enough, Chief, fair enough. It's just a shame is all. That's what I'm saying. Just a shame."
"There's three of them," said Dogman. "Northmen for certain, but hard to tell their clan. Being as they're down here, I'm guessing they follow Bethod."
"More than likely," said Tull. "Seems that's the fashion these days."
"Just three?" asked Three Trees. "No reason for Bethod to have three men on their own all the way out here. Must be more nearby."
"Let's deal with the three," growled Dow, "and get to the rest later. I came here to fight." "You came here 'cause I dragged you here," snapped Three Trees. "You was all for turning back an hour ago."
"Ah," said Grim.
"We can get around them if we need to."
Dogman pointed through the cold woods.
"They're up on the slope there in the trees. No trouble to get round them."
Three Trees looked up at the sky, pink and grey through the branches, and shook his head.
"No, we're losing the light, and I wouldn't like leaving them behind us in the dark. Since we're here, and since they're here, we'd best deal with them. Weapons it is."
He squatted down, talking quiet.
"Here's how we'll do it. Dogman, get round and above, up on that slope there. Take the one on the left when you hear the signal. You follow me? The one on the left, and best not to miss."
"Aye," said Dogman, "on the left."
Not missing, more or less, went without saying.
"Now, you slide in quiet and take the middle."
"The middle,"
growled Dow. "He's done. That leaves one for you, Grim."
Grim nodded without looking up, rubbing at his bow with a rag.
Nice and clean, boys. I don't want to be putting one of you in the mud over this. Places, then.
The dogman found a good spot up above Bethod's three scouts and watched from behind a tree trunk. Seemed like he'd done this 100 times, but it never got any easier on the nerves. Probably just as well. It's when it gets easy that a man makes mistakes. Dogman was watching for him, so he just caught sight of Dow in the fading light, slithering up through the brush, eyes fixed ahead on his task. He was getting close now, real close. Dogman knocked an arrow and took an aim at the one on the left, breathing slow to keep his hand steady. It was then that he realized. Now he was on the other side. The one that had been on the left was on the right. So which one should he shoot? He cursed to himself, struggling to remember what Three Trees said. Get around and take the one on the left. Worst thing of all would have been to do nothing, so he aimed up at the one on his left and hoped for the best. He heard Three Trees call from down below, sounding like a bird out in the woods. Dow gathered himself to jump. Dogman let his arrow fly. It thudded into the back of his task, just as Grimm's arrow stuck him in the front, and Dow seized hold of the middle one and stabbed him from behind. That left one of them untouched and very surprised-looking.
"Shit,"
whispered the dogman.
"Help!"
screamed the last of them, before Dow jumped on him. They rolled in the leaves, grunting and thrashing. Dow's arm went up and down, once, twice, three times. Then he stood up, glaring through the trees and looking mighty annoyed. Dogman was just shrugging his shoulders when he heard a voice behind him.
"What?"
Dogman froze, cold all over. Another one, out in the bushes, not 10 strides away. He reached for an arrow and knocked it, real quiet, then turned slowly round. He saw two of them, and they saw him, and his mouth went sour as old beer. They all stared. Dogman aimed at the bigger one and pulled the string right back.
"No!"
he shouted. The arrow thudded into his chest, and he groaned and stumbled, fell down on his knees. Dogman dropped his bow and made a snatch at his knife, but he hadn't got it drawn before the other one was on him. They went down hard in the brush and started rolling. Light dark, over and over they went down the slope, kicking and tearing and punching at each other. Dogman's head smacked against something, and he was down on his back, wrestling with this bastard. They hissed at each other, not words exactly, sounds, like dogs make fighting. The man pulled his hand free and got a blade out from somewhere, and Dogman caught his wrist before he could stab it home. He was pushing down with all his weight, both hands on the knife. Dogman was pushing the other way, both hands on his wrists, hard as he could, but not hard enough. The blade was coming down slowly, down towards Dogman's face. He was staring at it cross-eyed, a tooth of bright metal not a foot from his nose.
"Die, you fucker!"
And it came down another inch. The dogman's shoulders, his arms, his hands were burning, running out of strength. Staring at his face, stubble on his chin, yellow teeth, pockmarks on his bent nose, hair hanging down around it. The point of the blade nudged closer. Dogman was dead, and there was no help for it. Snick. And his head wasn't there anymore. Blood washed over Dogman's face, hot and sticky and reeking. The corpse went slack, and he shoved it away. Blood in his eyes, blood up his nose, blood in his mouth. He staggered up, gasping and choking and spitting.
"All right, Dogman, you're all right."
Tull must have come up on them while they were struggling.
"I'm still alive,"
Dogman whispered, the way Logan used to when a fight was done.
"Still alive."
By the dead, though, that had been a close thing.
"They ain't got too much in the way of gear," Dow was saying, poking round the campsite.
Cookpot on the fire, weapons and such like, but not much food, not enough to be all alone out there in the woods.
"Scouts, maybe," said Three Trees. "Outriders for some bigger band?"
"Reckon they must be," said Dow.
Three Trees slapped his hand down on the dogman's shoulder.
"You all right?"
He was still busy trying to rub the blood off his face.
I think so."
Bit shaky still, but that would settle.
"Cuts and scrapes, I reckon. Nothing I'll die off."
Good, because I can't spare you. Why don't you take a creep up through them trees and have a look-see while we clear up this mess here? Find who these bastards were scouting for.
Right enough, said the dog man, sucking in a big breath and blowing it out. Right enough.
Stupid bloody job, eh, Dow? Whispered Three Trees. Work fit for boys and we're lucky to get it. What do you say now?
Could be I made a mistake.
A big one, said the dog man.
There were 100 fires burning down there on the dark slopes, 100 fires and more. There were men down there too, it hardly needed saying. Thralls mostly, lightly armed, but plenty of carls as well. Dogman could see the last light of the day glinting on their spear tips and their shield rims and their mail coats, polished up and ready for a fight, clustered round close to the flapping standards of each clan's chieftain. Lots of standards. 20 of them, or 30 even, at a quick count. The dogman had never seen more than 10 together before.
"Biggest army that's ever been out of the north," he muttered.
"Aye," said Three Trees. "All fighting for Bethod, and not 5 days' ride from the Southerners."
He pointed down at one of the banners.
"That Littlebone standard down there?"
"Aye," growled Dow and spat into the brush. "That's his mark, all right. I got scores with that bastard."
"There's a world of scores down there," said Three Trees. "That's Pale of Snow's banner, and Whitesides, and Crendel Goring's over by them rocks. That's some bloody company. Them as went over to Bethod near the beginning. All grown fat on it now, I reckon."
"What about them ones?"
asked the dog man, pointing out at some that he didn't recognize. Evil-looking signs, all leather and bones. Looked like hillmen's marks to him, maybe.
"That ain't Cromachy Fail's standard, is it?"
"Nah. He'd never have kneeled to Bethod or anyone else. That mad bastard'll still be up there in the mountains somewhere, calling to the moon and all the rest."
"Less Beth or damn for him," grunted Dow.
Three Trees shook his head.
"Doubt it. Canny bastard, that Crummock. Been holding Bethod off for years up in the high places. He knows all the ways, they say."
"Whose signs are they, then?" asked Dogman.
"Don't know. Could be some boys from out east, past the Grinner. There's some strange folk out that way. You know any of them banners, Grim?"
"Aye,"
said Grim, but that was all he said.
"Don't hardly matter whose signs they are," muttered Dow. "Just look at the numbers of them. There's half the fucking north down there."
"And the worst half," said Dogman.
He was looking at Bethod's sign set up in the middle of the host. A red circle daubed on black hides, an acre of them, it looked like, big as a field, mounted on a tall pine trunk, flapping evil in the wind. Huge great thing.
"Wouldn't fancy carrying it," he muttered.
Dow slithered over and leaned in close.
"Might be that we could sneak in there in the dark," he whispered. "Might be we could sneak in and put a blade in Bethod."
They all looked at each other. It was a terrible risk, but Dogman had no doubts it was worth the trying. Wasn't a one of them hadn't dreamed of sending Bethod back to the mud.
"Put a blade in him, the bastard,"
muttered Tull, and he had a smile right across his face.
"Aye,"
grunted Grim.
"That's a task worth doing," hissed Dow. "That's real work."
Dogman nodded, looking down at all them fires.
"No doubt.
Noble work. Work for named men like them, or like they used to be, maybe. There'd be some songs about that, all right." Dogman's blood was rushing at the thought, skin prickling on his hands. But Three Trees was having none of it.
"No. We can't risk it. We gotta go back and tell the Union. Tell them they got guests coming. Bad guests, and in numbers."
He tugged at his beard, and Dogman could tell he didn't like it. Backing off. None of them did, but they knew he was right, even Dow. Chances were they'd never get to Bethod, and if they did, they'd never get out.
"We gotta go back," said Dogman.
"Fair enough,"
said Dow. We go back. Shame, though.
Aye, said Three Trees. Shame.
Chapter 12 Long Shadows.
By the dead.
Pharaoh said nothing, but for the first time since Logan met her, the scowl had slipped off. Her face was slack, mouth hanging slightly open. Luthar, on the other hand, was grinning like a fool.
You ever see anything like that?
He shouted over the noise, pointing out at it with a trembling hand.
There is nothing else like that, said Baez.
Logan had to admit that he'd been wondering what all the fuss was about when it came to crossing a river. Some of the bigger ones in the north could be a problem, especially in the wrong season and with a lot of gear to carry. But if there was no bridge, you found a good ford, held your weapons over your head and sloshed across. Might take a while for your boots to dry out, and you had to keep your eyes well open for an ambush, but otherwise there was nothing much to fear from a river. Good place to fill your water skin. Filling your skin at the Eos would have been a dangerous business, at least without 100 strides of rope. Logan had once stood on the cliffs near Ufrith and watched the waves crash against the rocks far below, the sea stretching away, grey and foaming out of sight. A dizzy and a humbling and a worrying place to stand. The feeling at the brink of the great river's canyon was much the same, except that a quarter mile away or so, another cliff rose up from the water. The far bank, if you could use the word about a towering rock face. He shuffled up gingerly to the very edge, prodding at the soft ground with the toes of his boots, and peered over the brink. Not a good idea. The red earth overhung slightly, bound up with white grass roots, and then the jagged rocks dropped away, almost sheer. Where the frothing water slapped against them far below, it sent great plumes of bright spray into the air, clouds of damp mist that Logan could almost feel on his face. Tufts of long grass clung to the cracks and the ledges, and birds flitted between them, hundreds of small white birds. Logan could just make out their twittering calls over the mighty rumble of the river. He thought on being dropped into that thundering weight of dark water, sucked and whirled and ripped around like a leaf in the storm. He swallowed and shuffled cautiously back from the edge, looking around for something to cling on to. He felt tiny and weightless, as if a strong gust of wind might snatch him away. He could almost feel the water moving through his boots, the surging, rolling, unstoppable power of it, making the very earth tremble.
"So you can see why a bridge might be such a good idea," shouted Baez in his ear.
"How can you even build a bridge across that?"
"At Aostum, the river splits in three, and the canyon is much less deep. The Emperor's architects built islands and made their bridges of many small arches. Even so, it took them 12 years to build. The bridge at Darmium is the work of Canadius himself, a gift to his brother Juvens when they were yet on good terms. It crosses the river in a single span. How he did it, none now can say."
Baez turned for the horses.
"Get the others. We should keep moving."
Pharaoh was already walking back from the brink.
"So much rain."
She looked over her shoulder, frowned, and shook her head.
"Don't get rivers like that where you come from, eh? Out in the Badlands, water is the most precious thing you can have. Men kill over a bottle of it." "That's where you were born, the Badlands."
A strange name for a place, but it sounded about right for her.
"There are no births in the Badlands, Pink, only deaths." "Harsh land, eh? Where were you born, then?"
She scowled.
"What do you care?"
"Just trying to be friendly."
"Friends,"
she sneered, brushing past him towards the horses.
"Why? You got so many out here you couldn't use another."
She stopped, half turned, and looked at him through narrowed eyes.
"My friends don't last, Pink."
"Nor do mine, but I reckon I'll take the risk if you will."
"All right,"
she said, but there was nothing friendly in her face.
The Gurkish conquered my home when I was a child, and they took me for a slave. They took all the children.
A slave?
Yes, fool, a slave. Bought and sold like meat by the butcher. Owned by someone else, and they do as they please with you, like they would with a goat, or a dog, or the dirt in their gardens. That what you want to know, friend?
Logan frowned.
We don't have that custom in the North.
Sss, she hissed, lip curling with scorn. Good for fucking you.
The ruin loomed over them. A forest of shattered pillars, a maze of broken walls, the ground around it strewn with fallen blocks as long as a man was tall. Crumbling windows and empty doorways yawned like wounds. A ragged black outline chopped out from the flying clouds like a giant row of broken teeth.
What city was this?
Asked Luther.
No city, said Baez. At the height of the old time, at the greatest extent of the Emperor's power, this was his winter palace.
All this?
Logan squinted at the sprawling wreck.
One man's house?
And not even the whole year round. Most of the time, the court would stay in Alcus. In winter, when the cold snows swept down off the mountains, the Emperor would bring his retinue here. An army of guardsmen, of servants, of cooks, of officials, of princes, and children and wives, making their way across the plain ahead of the cold winds, taking up residence here for 3 short months in the echoing halls, the beautiful gardens, the gilded chambers.
Baez shook his bald head.
In times long past, before the war, this place glittered like the sea beneath the rising sun.
Luthar sniffed.
So Lestrade tore it down, I suppose?
No. It was not in that war, but another that it fell many years later. A war fought by my order after the death of Juvens against his eldest brother.
Canadius, muttered Quai, the master maker.
A war just as bitter, just as brutal, just as merciless as the one before, and even more was lost. Juvens and Canadius both, in the end.
Another happy family, muttered Logan.
No.
Baez frowned up at the mighty wreckage.
With the death of the Maker, the last of the 4 sons of Eos, the old time ended. We are left only with the ruins and the tombs and the myths. Little men kneeling in the long shadows of the past.
Pharaoh stood up in her stirrups.
There are riders, she barked, staring off at the horizon. 40 or more.
Where?
Snapped Byers, shading his eyes.
I don't see anything.
Nor could Logan. Only the waving grass and the towering clouds. Longfoot frowned.
I see no riders, and I am blessed with perfect vision. Why, I have often been told that
you want to wait until you see them, hissed Pharaoh, or get off the road before they see us.
We'll head into the ruins, snapped Baez over his shoulder, and wait for them to pass. Malachus, turn the cart.
The wreck of the Winter Palace was full of shadows and stillness and decay. The outsized ruins towered around them, all covered with old ivy and wet moss, streaked and crusted with the droppings of bird and bat. The animals had made the place their palace now. Birds sang from 1,000 nests high in the ancient masonry. Spiders had spun great glistening webs in leaning doorways, heavy with sparkling beads of dew. Tiny lizards sunned themselves in patches of light on the fallen blocks, swarming away as they came near. The rattling of the cart over the broken ground, the footfalls and the hoofbeats echoed back from the slimy stones. Everywhere water dripped and ran and plopped in hidden pools.
Take this, Pink.
Pharaoh slapped her sword into Logan's hands.
Where are you going?
You wait down here and stay out of sight.
She jerked her head upwards.
I'll watch them from up there.
As a boy, Logan had never been out of the trees round the village.
As a young man, he'd spent days in the high places, testing himself against the mountains. At Hionnan in the winter, the hillmen had